Anyway, thank you very much to Bob for putting this together, and thanks so much to Fred and to Rick. And thanks for everybody for coming, especially Sharon and Carrie, who fought the traffic. So I asked Rick if I could read a poem of his, since we weren't hearing any of his work tonight. And he sent me this one. I'm having trouble sort of figuring out a good space. So this is called On Being Asked for a Poem That Embodies Non-Anthropocentric Spirituality. As a kid, I had a rock collection and didn't learn anything from it. Not the scientific names, not the way they formed so long before us, or the way they'll continue eons after. I should, you say, have held them to my ear hour after hour and listened to their silence, to the pure, inhuman shape of them. But I'd have heard instead the low, dark rumble of my blood. I kept them in a box that I marked stones, a box I got from my father, thick pasteboard with lots of gold gilt edging the corners. You could still smell the cigars, Coronas they must have been, with a picture of peacocks and dark-haired woman on a gold divan. He traveled a lot, and I missed him dearly. And when he came back, he'd bring me a purple agate or once a plastic rocket powered by a water pump. It never reached the stars, the haze of coronas, the darkened dwarfs, the imponderable empty spaces between them. It got about as high as our maple tree. There's no getting around it. Whenever I try to think of stones, all of the rest comes too. So when the microphone makes that noise, is that unpleasant or is that okay? Okay. So it's so springy today. I'm reading a spring poem called Adirondacks May. Let it be night when you plunge on wheels through the ravenous forest. Bats, ecstatic, twist into illumined view and shoot upward. The lewd-faced possum trails his nude tail into the spotlight of your high beams. At the bend, there, nibbling, the doe bares her throat to your oncoming glare, tracks you sideways in the gaze of her one eye in light. And you see that it's your own slow longing she's captured in the neck, the tongue, in the lithe, submissive body. Let the trees claw at wind. The moon, half occluded, is your lost eye opening. The road is a nerve stem through hemispheres of trees, and your tense rabbit heart is the double blade of light calling out to the dark. This poem's called Go West, and it's for my mother. At 92, she'll move to Hollywood. Get closer. At 92, she'll move to Hollywood, shrugging off the ground of 7 decades, the dirt she worked, Midwestern fertile crescent of mispronounced Egyptian names. Its cliffs and wooded hills, its lakes with their attendant herons, ducks, bald eagles that return to winter nests, the cardinals and finches at her feeder, the rows of corn and soy, and headstones. How much of this landscape is still active in her system? Her life in southern Illinois has shrunk to a few faces, fewer rooms, a pool, a list of numbers, humidity that holds her like a pair of arms, a chair looking out on a mown field, the visitations of the ruby-throated hummingbird. No one visits. Those who do talk too much, laugh at things that aren't funny. They don't enunciate. They inflect each statement as if it were a question. Go west, old woman. It's not her first migration. She typed her way through war in mucklucks on a Kodiak Island naval base, her flight from all that was familiar. The promise now is sunshine and blood. She'd look toward death as her next big adventure or her escape from joint pain. Her son's kicking like firemen, one to nudge her out, the other waiting with a net. Aloft, she circles ocean, freeways, mountains with their dirty skirts, the city's fabric stitching into the brown hem of sky in three directions. She wakes to a birdless world and to the strange drone of traffic, and to red clay roofs, to balconies of bougainvillea spilling over wrought iron. What do you remember, Vecchia of the Mediterranean? I balconi, I tetti rossi come questi. There's music that isn't Christian, food that isn't fried, Tai Chi in wheelchairs, smatterings of Yiddish, performers just a step ball change from Broadway, orange trees in planters, their bright fruit ripe for the plucking by anybody who can reach. The pool is not a euphemism. It's a bathtub. Visitors surge in and recede like the ocean she never sees. For 80 minutes daily, the sun lights up the concrete courtyard. So this is called... Sorry, I'm dealing with this thing so weirdly. This cold night will turn us. My brother is suddenly jobless, impossible. He's the family genius, the physicist, two kids bound for college, big house on a lake. He says days are okay, but nights he wakes sweating. It's 25 below in Minnesota. Even the Malamute won't go out. He skis across a lake by day, the week before him, shoreless. In his LinkedIn photo, he looks faded. I can't bear to connect him to the verb network. It has nothing to do with performance, they said. It's salary and age. You cost us too much, you and everyone like you, with your bald heads and metal hips, your long memories, your quaint loyalties. This is called Maple Grove, and it's the changed name of a hospital my father was in at the end of his life. They put him in the left wing, but by then, he lacked a sense of serendipity or irony. He enjoyed the words, though. Sinister nurses, window on the parking lot. He no longer drove. He'd lost his mind sometimes. It came back for visits and left, like the rest of us. Then he lost his last name. The first shall be the last also. Did they think he wouldn't know himself as Edelman, professor, mister? They had time for one syllable, Milt. They were underpaid. So there went his parents, brothers, kids, adulthood. What's in a family name? Everything stank. Real flowers smelled like plastic. He no longer walked. He was not often pleasant. He'd lost his heart's sweetness sometimes. Of course he preferred the past. He could get there on his own, for one thing. The ice house at Lily Lake, where he hid with his twin on hot afternoons. Like this one, the one in which he tells me that story, coaxed out for minutes into blessed shade. Then he explains hydraulic brakes. I think the growling was involuntary. After a long snarl, he'd sigh, okay. Getting it all out, I guess. Like when he said, piss, shit. A man who never swore, who never liked my mother's cussing in her two mother tongues, though he admired her flair for juxtaposition. He was passing through stages like a toddler, learning language as he lost it. I buzzed the nurse. My father's gurgling. Gurgle, said my father, traveling backward toward the first spring of sound. Jerry O'Malley visited daily. Milton Edelman, he said it on arrival and departure. Jerry O'Malley, said my father to his friend, learning that to name the whole person is to hold him fast throughout the arc of his translation, to reconstitute him daily at the heart's table. This is called It Is Nor Hand Nor Foot in Mouth. Forgot to type your name. Forgot how to say it. Forgot the sound of it. I mean the spell of it. Forgot how to spell it. Forgot you had a name. Forgot you had a face below your hair, above your earrings. Forgot the meaning of your name. Forgot how to mean it. Forgot your name means stranger, Barbara, which is strange because you're so familiar. You're like family. I call you by my daughter's name. Her name is Rosemary. You're like a spice to me, a bloom. You're like a virgin. I call my daughter by her mother's name, that fiend. You're like a mother to me. You're like Helen Mirren in The Queen. No, scratch that. Helen Mirren's like my mother in The Queen. We saw it in an empty theater. You walked along the banister. You're like a cat to me, an acrobat. You're like prime suspect Helen Mirren. Forgot the root of your name. Forgot its trunk, its limbs, its tender intersections. So some of these are in my chapbook Exposure, which is on sale over here. This is called Automatic Email Reply, Out of Office Hospice. How did the air change just then, she thought, and then lost the thought. The curdling light, the nervous screen, the ringing in her ears, hard surfaces of tables spiked with metallic flecks. A public buzz from inside the light or inside the screen, or maybe not a buzz at all, not a sound, but a flicker that feels like a buzz. He had a buzz cut, said Aaron yesterday, looming over her after class. So you think he'd be like some military guy, but he was like seedy. I mean, what do you mean, she said. I mean like seedy. Well, how did you know, she said. No. What about him was seedy, she said. Well, he was like, you know, his clothes were two sizes too big, and he pulled up his hood so you could barely see his face, and every crappy thing he had on was like black or some other non-color. What else, she said. He was walking around with a weed whacker, said Aaron. But that was yesterday. She's sliding away from today, detouring into buzz cuts and weed whackers, into anything but the actual thing. Today is wet. This morning in Shakespeare, the students wanted badly to be sleeping, until she asked if they thought Bottom, with his donkey head, really wanted to eat those fairies, mustard seed and peas blossom, rather than befriend them. And then all their faces lifted, the private sleepiness of each, like a screen door sliding open, and they stared as if this, as if she were the dream, and what they wanted badly now was to waken away from her. Back in grad school, the seminar table always made her hungry. In Celia's story, she'd said, the Thanksgiving turkey is the dead father. And her classmates stared, the way the students this morning stared. But the prof, a man older than God, said, of course, they're carving the dead father and eating him with cranberry sauce. But that's much farther back than her earlier tangent, much further from the now of an hour ago that she's been sitting on like a bruise. This afternoon in the wobbly light, in the inner ear ringing of a phone or doorbell that will not stop ringing, at the hesitant screen, in the sickly light, the sidewalks wet through arched windows, she scrolled by a subject line like something red blinking on a mountain road through fog and kept strolling, didn't stop to open, thinking maybe that's the name of an article Carol is sending, or maybe it's one of her spiky jokes, and then thinking, no. She doesn't do that anymore. So I've just got two more. I just want to get a drink. Well, this is called Exposure One. When I wrote this chapbook, I decided that I was going to write a chapbook and name all the poems in it Exposure. But I didn't end up doing that, but I named three of them Exposure. Exposure One. I was talking to a shrink about lack of focus, and she said, here's an extreme example. A woman cleaning her house who stopped scrubbing the kitchen to get a rag from the closet, and from there, see, she'd started dusting the bedroom and stopped to get cleaner from the kitchen, so she resumes dusting the bedroom, forgetting the kitchen, until she walks to the bathroom to dampen the dust cloth and sees the cabinet open and empty and remembers she'd been cleaning the cabinet when she went to the kitchen to get cleaner and noticed that she'd been scouring the sink when... Well, in fact, the therapist said only a few of these words, and I plugged myself right in. I am that extreme example, I said. But are you sure it slows my cleaning? And she said, ah, but the woman cleaning is a metaphor, a capsule of actual behavior. Thus, literal speed of metaphorical cleaning is irrelevant. And I thought then of cleaning as metaphor for therapy, a monologue confined to one room within a circumscribed time. And would a portion of my brain be cleaner when I emerged? I thought of monologue as metaphor for type A cleaning, and of my more expansive style as dialogue among all rooms, which are rooms of the self, another shrink told me when I dreamed the delicious dream of more and more rooms opening up off my one-room apartment. More space, I rejoiced, but he said, no, more parts of the self. And I loved that too, my very selves as multiplying square footage. And then he said, more parts of Barbara. And when he did that third person thing, I thought several things at once. Oh God, he's one of those. If his face were gigantic, it would make an excellent climbing wall. Is he talking about some other Barbara? And if so, what's the point of extra rooms if I have to share? So this last one is called The Carriage House. For years, I've returned in sleep to a guest house on an alley that smelled of eucalyptus, where a blonde girl walked her little son to school and home each day. I moved across the country, but can't seem to exit that home, elf-like and low in a culture of sun, where inside and outside were hard to divide, where ivy tightened around the stucco frame, the oak floor, casement windows, walled-in yard, the ancient swing. I think that I inhabit two places at once, a spacious one by day, and the dollhouse I return to like a ghost at night, that I enter without key, without cost, that someone else inhabits now, though as a dreamer I can't see her. Some nights I move the guest house to the middle of a wood, and some nights thieves stand in shadows at the broken back door. What is it I can't let go of? The person I think I was when I lived there? I gave the little boy my stuffed bear and left, wishing I had something for the other child, his mother. I wake and carry my divided self through day, relief of green, of locusts, hemlocks, oaks, my porch, my cat, my several rooms, the cry of a young hawk repeated. Thank you.